Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I have a very special guest with me this week. I have Deborah Warren. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for joining me. And you are on because you have just released a book that you wrote called Robert Preston, Forever the Music Man, which is a very detailed, thoughtful biography of Robert Preston. Of course, we all know him from The Music Man and his other Broadway credits. And a lot of people, a lot of theater fans, I don't know, remember or realize that he had a film career prior to that in Hollywood, you know, starting in the late 30s. But most people know him from his Broadway credits. But I wanted to start off by asking you how this book came about, because you've never written like a celebrity biography before, right?
No, I've written several historical books for local entities, towns, churches, things of that nature, but not a celebrity biography. It really was born of a pandemic project, actually. We were all, I think everybody was going a little bit stir crazy, cooped up during the height of the pandemic. And this became my project. I was skimming through, surfing the internet, and came upon the Robert Preston page. And one of the things that I noticed, comments from many of the group members, was that information, biographical information, a biography of Mr. Preston was not available, and people were very interested in that. So, of course, taking up the challenge, I started digging and uncovered mountains of information and began compiling that. And then I realized, my goodness, I might as well just put this into book form. The other thing that happened that was a strange thing connected to Mr. Preston happened maybe, I want to say, 38 years ago or so. I had an unusual experience. I dreamt a whole feature-length movie with Mr. Preston in it, Pierce Brosnan in it, Rue McClanahan, a whole cast of people. It was about a robotics company. It was kind of prescient of some of the things that are going on today with IT, et cetera. And I woke up and I wrote down everything and actually made that into a screenplay and did try to get that vehicle put forward, and it never went anywhere. But I also wrote the screenplay as well. So that was another connection with him way back when I was in my early 20s. And so that was the connection with Robert Preston. And I began, like I said, researching and compiling information. And then that led me to reach out to various celebrities that are still with us, who worked with Mr. Preston, and I was able to gain invaluable insight from them about his personality, his acting style, and all, you know, many of the films and, vehicles that he was in.
And it's interesting because as you read the book, you start to get an understanding as to why this would be such a challenge, because he was an extremely private person. There's so many comments throughout the book from coworkers and collaborators of his about how wonderful he was to work with and how terrific he was on the set and what a team player he was. But at the same time, they also end up saying something along the lines of, but I never really knew him, because once he left the set or left the theater in New York, we never saw him. His private life was so private that it's not, as I was reading, I'm like going, my goodness, Deborah had to really dig, must have had to really dig, because he didn't really share a lot.
He didn't. He was very charming, very personable, made sure that he had very good relationships with his co-stars. You probably read in the book, both with Mary Martin in particular, Barbara Cook. He would go into their dressing rooms prior to a show and engage in long conversations, but they were about topics of the day or the weather or, you know, various types. It wasn't about his personal life. He didn't share a whole lot of information. So he wanted to make sure he had that connection, but was still very, very guarded. The only person he really let his guard down with was his wife, Catherine.
Right.
Now, his parents obviously knew him very well, and his brother. But outside of that, it was his wife in his adult life
right.
that was the person that knew him and that he felt comfortable sharing his innermost thoughts and feelings with.
Right. And that started, you know, really early on. He sort of compartmentalized work and family as two completely separate things, because even when he was in Hollywood, he had, just to let our listeners know, he actually had kind of started, he was from California, but he started his acting career at the Pasadena Playhouse, which I have been to many times here in the Los Angeles area, where he did many, many, many productions. And it was there that he eventually got picked up by Paramount Pictures in the late 30s and put under contract. But even when he was under contract to Paramount, you know, he and his wife, they had a nice house, but not a huge palatial mansion with tons of servants. And they didn't do the Hollywood parties. They didn't do, and they kind of kept to themselves. He certainly had friends in the business, but he really kept everything separate. And that kind of continued throughout his entire life, correct?
Yes. And one of the things, when I spoke with his niece, she indicated that he kept what she called a New England sensibility. He was originally born just outside of Boston. Family was from the New England area, and then transplanted themselves in the Los Angeles area when he was about two. But they brought all their values, their, you know, cuisine, their values, everything with them. And so he carried that with him throughout his life. Very frugal, very, you know, kind of kept everything close to the vest. So that certainly speaks to what you were talking about. And Catherine herself also was not an extravagant type person, very intelligent. And I think the two of them meshed very well together as a couple.
Mm-hmm. And she was an actress too, I should point out. She was also an actress too, who did quite a few films, usually in smaller bit parts. Yes. But she was definitely working the scenes at the same time he was early on. Yes. But one of the things I loved about the book was it sort of felt as though he would fall into these various career paths without necessarily a lot of forethought that he was going to do it. It was sort of like, you know, the movies landed in front of him and he said, oh, okay, I'm going to try the movies. And regardless of how he was treated or how bad or good the material was on anything he was working on, he constantly was professional and gave it his all, regardless of what it was. He would see it through to the end. He certainly clashed with some people like Cecil B. DeMille, which is in the book, because Cecil B. DeMille took credit for discovering Robert Preston, which was completely not true. But talk a little bit about that, because it's sort of interesting how, whether it was the movies or going to theater in New York or TV, these things were not necessarily, he didn't have like this master plan career-wise of what he wanted to do. He just kind of kept falling into things and showing how good he was as an actor in all these areas.
Right. One of the things that he mentioned several times during his life was that he felt he was very lucky, and that when something maybe fell through, an offer, a contract, whatever fell through, something else always came along that was better, whether it was on stage or screen or television. And so that kind of fueled the trajectory of his career, both on Broadway and in Hollywood. The other thing, he starred in a lot of different movies, a lot of B movies, some A-list movies, and some of them were flops too. Some of the Broadway productions and the movies were not critical favorites, but he never complained. He looked at those, all of the vehicles that he was in, his learning experiences to hone his craft. He was a perfectionist and, you know, was able to honestly take a look at some of the things he was in that maybe did not go so well, and was able to learn so that for the next time he could maybe approach the part a little bit better, whatever. So he was always forward thinking that way. And yes, was very, very lucky. Some of these, for instance, his Broadway debut was very serendipitous. He happened to stop in Broadway after coming back from England doing Cloudburst and ran into Jose Ferrer, and who happened to want to extricate himself from 20th Century because he had a movie in Hollywood. And so there began his Hollywood, his Broadway career. So things like that happened throughout his lifetime. And the other thing is he had a, again, this was a part of the New England ethic, I believe. He felt that an actor could be working continuously, and he proved that that was true. And he felt that it didn't have to be in blockbuster movies or necessarily in a smash hit on Broadway. Even if it was something on TV, regional theater, off Broadway, whatever, that there were opportunities for actors to work if they so desired. And his mantra was, it's better to be working at something than working at nothing. Mm-hmm. And also, in doing so, honing your craft as an actor. And that's how he lived his life.
Right. And that's one of the things I really enjoyed about the book, was seeing how everything for him was all about the work. And it was all about doing the best, honing his craft and doing the best job possible, even under the worst circumstances, and keeping a great attitude about things, but also knowing when to say no and knowing when to not take on something, which we'll talk about a little bit later, because there's a specific moment that was kind of a surprise to me. But I also love that as people will read, I'm not going to give everything away because I want people to purchase the book and read it for themselves, but there's some really interesting foreshadowing that happens a few times in the book. The one that I will point out is in 1941, he did a film called New York Town, which was a kind of a program picture at Paramount. And one of his co-stars was Mary Martin, who at that point had made a big splash on Broadway in the Cole Parter show, Leave It to Me, and had been put under contract, but never really found her footing in Hollywood. And of course, years later, they would be reunited on Broadway in the musical I Do, I Do. But we also have the foreshadowing that in the early 50s, he was supposed to do a film version of The Four Poster with Evelyn Keyes, which The Four Poster is the original play that I Do is based on. So it's sort of like these little things were kind of popping into his life, not realizing that much later on, they were going to circle back at some point and become a huge success for him.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. And there's a few of those in the book where you kind of read, and if you're familiar with his career, you kind of go, oh, I didn't realize that person popped up in his life that early, because they're certainly going to come back at some point. Talk about the marriage between him and Catherine Craig is probably one of the biggest takeaways from the book, is their relationship. Because he shared so much with her outside of his career, but he, and I don't even know how other way to put this, but he was involved in four very intense extramarital affairs. Yeah. And for someone, and it's almost like, and I the only way I could explain this is, it's almost like the way he committed himself to a project, whether it was good or bad, and saw it through and did the best he could with it, is almost how it comes across him handling these affairs. He like commits himself fully to these affairs, to the point where for such a private person, he's out in public, you know, with these women, these various women, and he's not hiding it. And he's even telling the press that he and his wife are separated and they're heading for divorce. And it's sort of like, he's like fully committed to leaving his wife and, you know, and going with Dorothy L'Amour or Peggy Lee or Glennis Johns or Ulla Sallert, who like she divorces, Ulla Sallert divorces her husband.
And so did Peggy Lee.
Right. I mean, it's like, but at the same time, he always goes back to Catherine. And it's just, it's so fascinating to read about.
Yes. I think, you know, it's, I don't want to psychoanalyze him, but yes, the relationship between Catherine Craig and Robert Preston is very unique. And I have had comments from women, especially who've read the book, fans and readers who've said, you know, they find the book, that part of the book fascinating, but say, gee, I'm surprised she didn't leave him, or I'm, you know, surprised she tolerated this. Let me just say that in talking with her family members that one of the things about Catherine Craig was that she was a pragmatist and she knew what she wanted out of life. And she was very forward thinking and she knew she wanted Robert Preston in her life and she was determined to keep him. And so that was one part of the puzzle. And it wasn't so much her being a wife who was cheated on, which, you know, she was cheated on or treated badly, et cetera. That was part of the puzzle. She didn't look at it that way. She looked at it. She told family members that life in the entertainment business was very hard. There was a lot of temptation and that was just the way it was. And so, you know, I can't speak to Broadway and Hollywood in the 30s to the 80s versus now and the difference, because of course there's a lot of infidelity and divorce that goes on. But in her mind, she saw that as part and parcel of the business, whether that was a good thing or bad thing on her part. She saw that as almost something to be expected. The temptations were around every corner and she didn't miss a beat in that. I mean, it hurt her, obviously. Mm-hmm. There were times when she would hole up on the beach and stay there and kind of wait it out. But she never gave up on the relationship and she never gave up on him. So that's one piece of it. And you're absolutely correct. For being such a private person, both Robert Preston and some of the paramours would regularly talk to the press. It was splashed across articles. In fact, in some of the instances, the reporters would call the wife, would call Catherine Craig and say, right, we understand, you know, Glynis Johns and your husband are going to be married, et cetera. And she'd say, there's going to be no divorce. I mean, she just, right. It was almost signaling to him because during those periods of time, there was very limited contact between Catherine Craig and Robert Preston. And it was almost like she was conveying the message through the press to her husband and to the paramour. This isn't going anywhere. So knock yourselves out. You know,
yeah.
And she knew, and the mother knew as well, both Catherine Craig and the mother knew that these relationships would be flash in the pan type relationships and wouldn't last. And they were both right.
Right. Reading it, it almost seemed to me, and again, I agree with you, I'm not going to try and psychoanalyze Robert Preston, but it almost felt like he almost treated some of the affairs, he almost treated like it was another acting role. And as soon as he went and did the role and he became the ultimate, you know, lover and boyfriend to these women, these various women, and played the role to the hilt, like he did with everything else he did, but did the publicity tour, basically being seen out in nightclubs and doing all the press stuff. But then once the role was over, which I think it ultimately would be every time he did this, he would just go home. You know, he would go home to his wife.
Yes. And I think part of that, part of the phenomena was, except with the exception of Dorothy L'Amour, but she herself was very exotic in it, you know, when she was doing all of these sarong movies.
Right.
She was seen as a kind of a, although she wasn't foreign, very exotic. And the same thing with Peggy Lee. How can you get more exotic than that? You know, she with her song Fever and she was just mesmerizing. But the other two women, Glynis Johns and Ulla Salar, were foreign. So they were exotic in that way. And I think he was drawn to these exotic women. I'll use that adjective. But when push came to shove, the only person he could really be himself with, as you're absolutely correct, it was kind of playing a role in these relationships, but he probably couldn't be himself. The only person he could truly let his hair down with and be himself was his wife. And I think he vacillated back and forth, you know, he put his toe in the water, so to speak, with these women. And would vacillate back and forth between Catherine and these various relationships. And I think when push came to shove, he realized that his security and his well-being, psychologically, every way, rested with his wife. And he ultimately went back to her every time.
Yeah, And I think by the end of the book, you see that he understands that Catherine is who he's meant to be with. Yes. I mean, I get the impression that he really truly loved Catherine.
He did.
And he really ultimately saw that, I think he saw what she saw, which was that all these affairs were just temptations that he took advantage of, but they were never meant really to be. Right. And I think he saw that, which is why he ultimately went back to Catherine. So of course the book is subtitled Forever the Music Man. So let's talk a little bit about the Music Man. Okay. Because it became almost a career defining role for him. And it's how most people remember Robert Preston, which is why I want them to read the book, because you will see so many other sides of Robert Preston in this book than just the Music Man. But talk a little bit about how the Music Man came about and how he was cast.
Yes. Well, prior to 1957, he was in a variety of movie roles, and he was also on Broadway in a couple shows, obviously not musicals,
shows. Right.
But he did take a few lessons, not very many. He could see that the musical theater genre was becoming popular, and so he took a couple lessons, but not many. And Meredith Willson obviously wrote The Music Man and hooked up with Kermit Bloomgarden to produce this musical on Broadway. And they were able to cast pretty much every role in the production, but they were having difficulty casting Harold Hill. They just couldn't find the right person to suit Meredith Willson. He had a vision in his mind as to what Harold Hill, what his persona would be like. And they originally tried various song and dance men. They approached Danny Kaye and Ray Bolger and all these different people. And none of them really seemed to fit. And so finally, Kermit Bloomgarden and Mort DaCosta suggested Robert Preston. And Meredith Willson wasn't convinced. He had seen him in some of these B movies and on Broadway in some of these, I think it was The Hidden River, and thought, I don't know if that's going to be a good fit. And the two men, Bloomgarden and DaCosta, had seen Robert Preston in Philadelphia in a production and thought he would be perfect. And they asked him to audition for the role of Harold Hill, and they were blown away by his performance. He actually chose the most difficult song in the score, You Got Trouble, mm-hmm. and rehearsed that and auditioned with that piece. And they were blown away by it and said to Meredith Willson, you really need to see this. So they got on the plane the next day, came to California. He auditioned for Meredith Willson, and that was it. I mean, the minute he launched into You Got Trouble, that was it. Mm-hmm. And so much so, he was so, Wilson felt that Preston embodied Harold Hill, what he envisioned Harold Hill to be. And he felt so strongly about that, that when the movie was purchased by Warner Brothers, he insisted that Preston reprise the role on screen. There mm-hmm. were so many other people who wanted the role. Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, Jack Warner wanted Cary Grant and all these other people. He wanted a real big name to be in the film. And Meredith Willson said, no, this is my Harold Hill. This is who I envision as the person who is the role, and I'm not going to settle for anything less. And that's how he ended up being cast in the film as well.
A pool table, don't you understand? Friend, either you're closing your eyes to a situation you do not wish to acknowledge, or you are not aware of the caliber of disaster indicated by the presence of a pool table in your community. Well, you got trouble, my friend. Right here, I say trouble right here in River City. Why, sure, I'm a billiard player. Certainly mighty proud to say I'm always mighty proud to say it. I consider that the hours I spend with a cue in my hand are golden. Help you cultivate horse sense and a cool head and a keen eye. Did you ever take and try to find an ironclad leave for yourself from a three-rail billiard shot? But just as I say, it takes judgment, brains, and maturity to score in a balk-line game, I say that any boob can take and shove a ball in a pocket. And I call that sloth the first big step on the road to the depths of degrade. I say first, medicinal wine from a teaspoon, then beer from a bottle. And the next thing you know, your son is playing for money in a pinchback suit. And listening to some big out-of-town Jasper, hearing him tell about horse race gambling. Not a wholesome trotting race, no, but a race where they set down right on a horse. Like to see some stuck-up jockey boy sitting on Dan Patch, make your blood boil? Well, I should say. Now, friends, let me tell you what I mean. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pockets in a table. Pockets that mark the difference between a gentleman and a bum, with a capital B, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. And all week long, your River City youth will be frittering away. I say your young men will be frittering. Frittering away there, noontime, suppertime, chore time too. Get the ball in the pocket. Never mind getting dandelions pulled or the screen door patched or the beach tank pounded. Never mind pumping any water till your parents are caught with the cistern empty on a Saturday night, and that's trouble. Yes, you got lots and lots of trouble. I'm thinking of the kids in the Knickerbocker, shirt-tail young ones, peeking in the pool hall window after school. You got trouble. Folks right here in River City. Trouble with a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. Now I know all you folks are the right kind of parents. I'm going to be perfectly frank. Would you like to know what kind of conversation goes on while they're loafing around that hall? They'll be trying out Bebo, trying out Cubabs, trying out TaylorMades like cigarette fiends, and bragging all about how they're going to cover up a telltale breath with Sen-Sen. One fine night, they leave the pool hall, heading for the dance at the armory. Libertine men and scarlet women and ragtime. Shameless music that'll grab your son, your daughter, with the arms of a jungle, animal instinct, masteria. Friends, the idle brain is the devil's playground. Trouble.
Oh, they got trouble.
Right here in River City.
Right here in River City.
With a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool.
That stands for pool.
We've surely got trouble.
They surely got trouble.
Right here in River City.
Right here.
Gotta figure out a way to keep the young ones moral after school.
Our children gonna have trouble. Trouble.
Mothers of River City,
trouble.
Heed that warning before it's too late. Watch for the telltale signs of corruption. The minute your son leaves the house, does he rebuckle his knickerbockers below the knee? Is there a nicotine stain on his index finger? A dime novel hidden in the corn crib? Is he starting to memorize jokes from Cap'n Billy's whiz bag? Are certain words creeping into his conversation? Words like swell, and so's your old man. Well, if so, my friends, you got trouble.
Oh, we got trouble.
Right here in River City.
Right here in River City.
With a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool.
That stands for pool.
We've surely got trouble.
We've surely got trouble.
Right here in River City.
Right here.
Remember the Maine, Plymouth Rock, and the Golden Rule.
Our children gonna have trouble.
Oh, we got trouble. We're in terrible, terrible trouble. That game with the 15-numbered balls is a devil's tool.
Devil's tool.
Oh, yes, we got trouble, trouble, trouble.
Oh, yes, we got trouble. Yes, we got big, big trouble.
With a T.
With a capital T.
Gotta rhyme it with P.
With a capital T.
And that stands for pool.
Of course, it's the role that everybody knows him from. And you can't, it's so funny because I think at this point you can't see anybody else playing the role. Because it also, to me, it's one of the reasons I encourage people to seek out some of his films prior to The Music Man, because you will see one of the things that's great about watching his old movies from the late 30s and all the way through the 40s is he's such a charismatic actor on screen that he kind of upstages everyone else in the film. Even some of the worst films, he stands out.
Yes.
In these movies because he's so different.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a strong, silent Gary Cooper type. He doesn't fit the mold of the typical Hollywood mold of an actor. So he really, I think the person I would say probably the closest he is maybe like a John Garfield, who also was very charismatic and also kind of rough around the edges,
mm-hmm.
which is what Preston was. But surprisingly, I don't know, after reading your book, I don't know that he felt that Harold Hill was his favorite musical role. It sounded like favorite was Pancho Villa, right?
Yes, yes. He was really sick about that. He lamented that We Take the Town did not take off. And that actually was his favorite role. He mentioned that. There was a episode of him on the Dinah Shore show, I want to say in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s. where he actually sings to Dinah. He sings some of the songs, and we take the town to her on the show. And he just, I mean, he was just sick that this show did not proceed. And there were various problems all the way around with it, not only with the book, with the producer, director. There was so many problems with the vehicle itself. But he really liked the character. He liked the story. And he felt that this could be, I don't want to say a reincarnation of Harold Hill, but it would be a character just as strong as Harold Hill. Mm-hmm. And it was just not meant to be. And that was just something that he regretted his entire life. And, you know, he had always hoped that We Take the Town could be revived somehow. It just never was for a variety of reasons. And, but that actually, yes, that was his favorite Broadway role. And people are surprised to hear that, because everyone assumes, because he's known for The Music Man and his spectacular portrayal of Harold Hill, that that would be his favorite. And it actually was not.
Right. Although I love the story. There's a little anecdote towards the end of the book when I can't remember what, I think it's a TV movie that he's doing, where they're sitting waiting for a setup, and somebody talks, they're talking about The Music Man with him. And he ultimately ends up performing the entire number of You Got Trouble, right, for the cast, yeah, that they're sitting around waiting, with all the choreography and everything. And this is like decades later.
let me clarify, although that wasn't his favorite role, he was very protective of his being Harold Hill. And the fact that he knew, he became very close to Meredith Willson, that he knew that Meredith Willson saw him as the penultimate Harold Hill, and he wanted to preserve that. Now, Forrest Tucker went on to do the national tour of Music Man, and there's been various people that have portrayed Harold Hill in revivals.
Yeah, I think Van Johnson did it in London, I think.
Yes, and Eddie Albert took over from him. There's also an anecdote in the book where I believe it was like 25 years later, they were doing on the Tony Award show reprisal of the all the shows that had come about in the last years. And Preston initially said, no, I'm not going to come on and do Harold Hill. And so they were going to then turn next to Forrest Tucker. And he's like, I'll be damned if somebody's going to do my role. So he was very protective of Harold Hill and the role, although it was not his favorite. He was very aware that that was his trademark, and he knew that the theme song, you know, the 76 Trombones, became associated with him. That was his theme song. They played that. They played him on at every, you know, Tony Awards, every, you know, production. That was his song. He knew that. He was tickled by it. And that was something that he didn't want anybody to take away from him. Although, like I said, he didn't want to necessarily be defined by that. There were other roles that he enjoyed as well.
So with the failure of We Take the Town, because it did have out-of-town tryouts, but it didn't. Mm-hmm. It fell apart and never came to Broadway. But his next Broadway musical was Ben Franklin in Paris, yes, which he shaved his head. Which I thought was interesting. He shaved his head so that they could get the proper kind of receding hairline that Benjamin Franklin was supposed to have. Talk a little bit about the production, because I know that there were kind of high hopes for the show, and it got very, very mixed reviews and still ran a decent number of performances. But of course, it's also where he meets Ulla Sallert, and where the final of his well-known extramarital affairs takes place during the show, which makes it even that much more complicated, because you've got a kind of a troubled show with him being the star and keeping the show afloat. And he's also having an affair with his leading lady, who she herself was sort of last minute casting because they couldn't find someone to play her role. So talk a little bit about Ben Franklin in Paris.
Yes, that was a show that he was very committed to. His wife, I think, I don't know if she was prescient or whatever, but she was dead set against him doing that role. She felt that he was in his 40s at the time, and he was playing a septuagenarian, and she just for a variety of reasons, she just absolutely did not want him to play the role. And he thought it would be very challenging. And so, of course, he proceeded to play the role. And it, you're correct. He shaved his head for the character. And the production crew was kind of taken aback. Somebody had made a comment that they would never have dreamed of asking him to shave his head. But he went and did that. I mean, that's how much he was committed to his roles. He saw that, you know, he had a massive head of hair, the wigs weren't working, and in order to come across as authentic, he shaved his head so that the wig could be put on in a receding hairline and more properly depict Ben Franklin. So that's what he did for that whole course of the show. I think one of the reasons the show sort of didn't take off was the casting of the Ulla Sallert character. And the producers had tried to get a hold of some of these more seasoned foreign actresses. And for whatever reason, either they weren't interested, they were busy. And they had to scramble at the last minute to get Ulla Sallert. She was a musical theater star in her native country. And so they flew her into audition and she got the role. Part of the problem, a lot of the critics opine that her English was unintelligible. When she, you know, even people sitting in the front rows of the theater, I think one critic described it as speaking in tongues. They just couldn't understand what she was saying most of the time. So I think that caused part of the problem, is that I think maybe if somebody else had been cast in that role, even an American actress that, you know, affected an accent, maybe would have been a better choice, but that's what they wanted to do at that time. And the other thing, Robert Preston was kind of a force and on Broadway and a name by that time. And a lot of the success of that show was pre-sales of tickets because of his star power of his name. So a lot of people purchased tickets and that kind of helped the show go as long as it did. So unfortunately, and that particular year, there were all these different, that seemed to be his trouble on some of these plays and musical theater productions, is that at the time he was appearing in these particular shows, that there were other blockbusters that were on Broadway at the time. And particularly at that time, I'd say the, you know, late 50s, early to mid 60s, there were so many wonderful shows that were being offered on Broadway that the public had their choice. And of course, they were going to go to these rousing, you know, A++ rated shows. This was a good show, but it wasn't on the same level as, say, a Hello, Dolly, or, you know, all other shows that hit Hollywood. And so, of course, that got left in the dust. So timing was sort of everything. There were some there were some problems with the book. There were some problems with casting with Ben Franklin in Paris. But I think part of it was just there were other shows that happened to be featured at the same time this show was running. And that particular production just fell on the wayside.
I love the ladies. I love them all. I can make them blush like Massachusetts in the fall. I love the ladies. Their sex I sing. I can make them leap like Allegheny Creeks in spring. So let us shoot off cannons and ring iron bells and all down a yard of beer. For the gentlemen love the ladies love them back, and that's how the devil we're here.
the ladies. My mother was one. And that I have in common with every other French-born son.
I don't adore a gang of men, but I enjoy a bevy. Upon your lap, who'd want a chap?
He'd be too bloody heavy.
You're right. I love the ladies. Is that a sin? I can make them gay as Gloucester when the ships come in.
I love the ladies. Each one's a poem. I can make them warm as kitchens in a Hampshire home.
Tempo!
Please!
So let us blow brass trumpets and beat bass drums and fiddle at each other's ears. For the gentlemen love the ladies love them back, and that's how the devil we're here. Yes, sir!
I love the ladies, 'tis plain to see. Liberties are what my politics demand of me.
Hear, hear! Hear, hear!
We love the ladies from port to port. Even British girls.
But only as a last resort.
So let us shout down rafters and all stamp our feet and holler out huzzas and cheer. Huzzah! For the gentlemen love the ladies love them back. And that's how the devil we're here. Yes, sir!
We love the ladies, heads down to toes. We can make them melt like April in the Poconos.
At every point of do or die throughout our male existence, a lady with a helping hand
has come to our assistance. All together, shout it out, for all the world to know that if we don't make heaven, we'll say, what the hell? We've all shared a first-class berth right here, where the gentlemen love the ladies love them back, and that's kind of heaven on earth. Yes, sir! That's kind of heaven on earth.
He also was not only just did musicals, he did plays and very successfully.
Yes,
I mean, he was a really wonderful stage actor. I think you say in the book that like Richard Burton thought he was like one of the best, you know, of the American actors to handle things like Shakespeare and stuff because his speaking voice was so good and he understood this.
Yes. He and Richard Burton forged a close relationship. The two of them acted together on, I believe it was like Mondays or something, Monday afternoons. Preston had rented the theater when he was doing The Music Man. Richard Burton was doing another play across the way, and they would do scenes together. And there were other actors who also got involved in this and did a lot of Shakespearean plays and acts and things like this. Just to hone their skills. Mm-hmm. And so that's how Burton got to see Robert Preston in action. And it's very interesting because John Cullum, who was close with Richard Burton and close with Robert Preston, indicated that Preston was the only person who Burton couldn't take the stage away from. He held his own with him. Mm-hmm. I think he was kind of impressed by that. They were both Shakespearean trained actors. And so he was very impressed with Robert Preston. And it's unfortunate that they weren't able to collaborate. They had talked about doing Othello, which, I mean, even at that time, late 70s, early 80s, I think would have been politically incorrect for two Caucasian men mm-hmm. doing Othello. But that was one of the things Rosemary Harris kind of was questioned and said, oh, my goodness. You know, I'm sure one of them would have had to go in blackface or when they alternated, that would have been very politically incorrect even at that time.
Right. Right.
And so I don't know how they were, what they were planning to do with that. But, you know, even if it wasn't Othello, if it was some other, you know, Hamlet or some other performance. It would have been interesting to have the two of them perform together, and what they wanted to do was alternate, you know, roles.
Yeah.
It would have been interesting for them to do something
right
on the Shakespearean stage.
And Rosemary Harris had done Lion in Winter with yes. Robert Preston, which I think a lot of people forget. I mean, people, when you say the Lion in Winter, they think of the movie version
yes.
With Katharine Hepburn, but they tend to forget that the play was Robert Preston and Rosemary Harris.
Yes.
And the two of them got along like gangbusters.
Yes, they had a very close friendship, and he enjoyed working with Rosemary. You know, her personality is just wonderful. I mean, she's a stupendous actress, very, very talented. That goes without saying. But her personality, it was just very easygoing. He just adored her. They adored each other and worked very well together. And that's one of the reasons his working relationship with Rosemary Harris is one of the reasons he agreed to do the Chisholm's miniseries many years later. He didn't like television per se. He didn't want to be typecast in a certain role or as a certain character on an ongoing TV series, but he couldn't pass up the opportunity to work with Rosemary. He knew it would be a great experience. And that kind of speaks to their dynamic together.
And he also, like I said earlier in the show, he ended up circling back and working with Mary Martin on I Do, I Do.
Yes.
And it sounds like the two of them had an absolute blast doing I Do, I Do, because they did it for a year on Broadway and then almost a full year on the road together.
Yes. And that's, and again, he adored Mary Martin. She adored him. It was a mutual admiration society. Mm-hmm. And because he had such a good relationship with Mary Martin, she was able to convince him to take the show on the road. I think if it had been anybody else, he would have declined. Mm-hmm. But they almost had a professional marriage. People mm-hmm. noticed that about them, is that not only were they portraying a married couple on stage in I Do, but they were like married professionally at that time. And so she was able to convince him to take the show on the road, which they did, for three quarters of the way until Mary Martin developed some medical problems. But yes, there again, he starred in New York Town many, many years before with Mary Martin. And I think that was part of her impetus for agreeing to do I Do, the musical. They had talked about getting Robert Preston for the role and other people. And she wasn't interested in doing the part of Agnes with anybody but him. Mm-hmm. And so they had to do a lot of convincing to get him to do the role. And so then she came on board once he was secured as Michael in that production. So they had a very wonderful relationship, and that made the show great.
I love my wife. What should I do? I've been to see a specialist, but when he was through, he told me it's hopeless. I'm stricken for life. My son, he said, get back to bed. You happen to love your wife. Other men love famous stars, but not I. The sort you worship from afar. And I try. Other men love femme fatales, sveltely dressed. But when I'm with those femme fatales, I get depressed. 'Cause I love my wife. How will it end? I love her as a lover and not just as a friend. It may be abnormal, with drama it's rife, but nevertheless, I confess, I love my wife. It may be abnormal, with drama it's right, but nevertheless, I confess,
Nevertheless, I confess, I love my wife. I love my wife. I love my wife. I adore my wife.
And then we come into a period of kind of interesting and relatively bizarre projects. He's picked by Lucille Ball to star with her in MAME, the film version of MAME,
yes,
which is fascinating. I mean, the movie has got such a bad reputation all these years later that it's really interesting to read about how, and it's one of those situations where it doesn't sound like it was the best working situation, but he made the most of it. But one of the things I thought was really interesting is talk a little bit about that very strange interview that they did with the Chicago Tribune, where the reporter basically is talking to Lucille Ball and Robert Preston is with her, yes, in the interview. And it's just so bizarre how she treats him during that interview.
Yes. Well, the whole production was marred by friction and, mm-hmm, there's different incidents of that. Even, you know, Madeline Kahn being cast and then fired. There were, ongoing rumors with Beatrice Arthur, and she was, you know, the wife of the director on top of it. Mm-hmm. But there were, you know, stories galore about the friction between the two women. And of course, they denied it up and down. Robert Preston denied it up and down. But I've seen clips of Beatrice Arthur subsequent, you know, many years later, where she talked, you know, you could just tell that her attitude toward that whole production was just, I mean, she was just disgusted by it. So you don't really know what went on behind the scenes, but it clearly wasn't good, because she didn't have a good vibe about the production. And like I said, there were all these rumors swirling around. And you're right, there was an interview done with Lucille Ball where she brings Robert Preston out and makes some, I don't know if she was trying to make a joke or just, you know, nervous or just trying to be disparaging, but there were, you know, she didn't address him. She made comments about his hair, different things like this. And he sat quiet. And that was, though, part of his MO. He just didn't want to get involved in any controversy. He wanted productions to run smoothly. And so I think he just wisely, as the reporter indicated, kept his mouth shut.
Mm-hmm.
He just wanted the movie to get done. He wanted to do the best job that he could. He didn't want to put any gasoline on the fire when it came to Lucille Ball or anybody else in the production. And he just kept his head down, nose to the grindstone, and did the job he was hired to do. So that whole movie was bizarre. I think Lucille Ball, I've seen interviews with her on the Johnny Carson show and other shows of that era, where she was determined to make this family-friendly movie. And she felt that there were, you know, at the time, there were a lot of movies coming out that were, I don't know if they were rated X at the time, but they were very sexually explicit. And she was very disturbed by that type of thing. So she wanted to make this family-friendly movie. And of course, for a variety of reasons, her age being one and other things, it just didn't go anywhere. And the critics pretty much panned the movie. And she was devastated by the response to the film. But yes, the whole backseat vibe was very, very strange on that movie.
And unfortunately for Preston, his next two musical forays for the stage are also not great. First up is Mac and Mabel, which, you know, based on, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but he was playing Mac Sennett. And he kind of wedged himself into the show because he apparently he got interested in it, but they had actually already cast Jerry Orbach to play Mac. And then he came in and took over as Mack Sennett. And of course, then there were problems with Mabel, who was Marcia Rodd. And then Marcia Rodd got fired and we ended up with Bernadette Peters. And it's sort of a show that, you know, when you read your chronicling of it in the book, it's a show that got progressively worse as it headed to Broadway.
Right. And that was one of the things that was just amazing. Typically, when you have, you know, previews of these show, of, you know, whether it's a play or musical theater, the whole purpose of previews is to tweak the shows and improve them so that by the time it gets to Broadway, you've got an A, Class A show. In mm-hmm. this case, from all reports, it just got worse. And they started out in San Diego, I believe, and it was like, you know, they went across the country. And by the time it ended up on Broadway, it was worse. I mean, from all accounts, it was a very good show when it started out. And then there were changes to the book and to the script that were unnecessary. And instead of working on the areas where that were problematic, attention was paid to other areas and the whole thing just kind of fell apart. I think it probably was a fairly good story to begin with. I think if Gower Champion hadn't done some of the things he did, I think the musical would have been better than it was, but it was what it was.
Movies were movies when you paid a dime to escape. Cheering the hero and hissing the man in the cape. Romance and action and thrills. Partner, there's gold in them hills. Movies were movies when during the titles you'd know. You'd get a happy ending, dozens of blundering cops in a thundering chase. Getting a bang out of lemon meringue in the face. Bandits attacking a train. One little tramp with a cane. Movies were movies were movies when I ran the show. Movies were movies when Pauline was tied to the track. After she trudged through the ice with the babe on her back. Girls at the seashore would stand all in a row in the sand. Rolling their stockings an inch and a quarter below. The line of decency and Swanson and Keaton and Dressler and William S. Hart. No one pretended that what we were doing was art. We had some guts and some luck, but we were just making a buck. Movies were movies when I ran the show. Art. No one pretended that what we were doing was art. We had some guts and some luck, but we were just making a buck. Movies, were movies when I ran the show.
And it's one of those, you know, lost shows that everybody loves because they love the score, but they just don't realize how problematic the book is and mm-hmm. and kind of what a mess it is. But they keep tinkering with it. They keep trying to get it to work. Yeah. And then he does The Prince of Grand Street, which is another show that closes on the road and doesn't get to Broadway, which I know was a disappointment to him. But then let's talk about Victor Victoria, because if people don't know Robert Preston from The Music Man, they probably know him from Victor Victoria, in which he plays Toddy. Right. And it sort of, to me, becomes the ultimate capper to his career. Because I love the comment he made, that because people are like, oh, it's a big comeback for him. And they kind of forget that he had just done another Blake Edwards movie, SOB, before right. that he got great reviews for. And I think he actually won one of the Critics Awards for that. Huh? So it wasn't like a real comeback, but the Victor Victoria was such a hit and got him his only Oscar nomination. Huh? Talk about Victor Victoria, because one of the things that's so amazing to me is he had no problem playing gay on screen, and basically told Blake Edwards, I am not going to play him as a stereotype. He's going to be just a regular, well-adjusted guy who just happens to prefer men. Right. And that's how he played him. And that was just kind of revelatory for the time period, right?
It was. But one of the things you have to understand is, I think Hollywood, to a degree, I mean, I think there's a lot of conservative people in Hollywood, especially today. There was back then too. He was very, very progressive for his day when it came to issues of, you know, gay Americans, Americans of color, you know, women's rights, whatever. I mean, he was just extremely progressive, and he dealt with many members of the gay community, whether it was, you know, in behind the scenes, acting, et cetera, directing. And his motto with everybody in life was, we're all human beings. I'm not going to, you know, stereotype these, you know, this particular character. As you mentioned, this is just a character who is a regular guy who happens to prefer men. And that's how he looked at, I mean, that was him in life. And I think that people were just amazed that he took the role, because at that time, we're talking, you know, the early 80s, that AIDS, everything came out, you know, 82, 83, 84 in that period of time. There was just kind of an apprehension among some in the in Hollywood to approach a role like that. And although that became more and more the norm in the years near that. But he had no problem with it whatsoever. There was an anecdote in the book, I think, where Blake Edwards talks about, he calls him up and says, hey, you're going to be Toddy, you're going to play gay. And Preston's going, okay, okay. And he was just shocked that there was not any hesitation about him playing that particular role. It was a role for him. He felt that he could, you know, step into it. And it didn't matter to him whether it was straight, gay, whatever. He was just going to do his best. And I think he should be applauded for that. I know the gay community really embraced him following that role, because he was so supportive just of the way he portrayed the character as a normal human being. And as we all are, you know, we're all human beings. Everybody has different personality traits, different preferences, different ways of different lifestyles, different whatever. It's all good. And he saw that. And, you know, he saw that, and they saw that. And I think they honored him for that, for being such a forward thinking person at that time, and kind of opening a lot of doors in people's minds, letting some of the scales fall from people's eyes just by his portrayal of that role.
And I think, if I remember correctly, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a moment where he gets honored for the role. And I can't remember if it's from a gay organization or one of the critics groups. And in accepting, he makes a statement sort of along the lines of, I know I've done a really good job with Toddy, because people say to themselves, wow, Robert Preston is doing an amazing job playing this gay character, and he's not even gay. Or is he? Right. Which is such a great remark.
Right. And I think he did that to kind of make people think, because it's, I mean, it's just, amazing to me that people are so close-minded and say, oh, you can only play a gay character if you're gay. You can only play a straight character if you're straight. You can only play, you know, whatever, which is just nuts. I mean, so I think he smashed that stereotype of we're all people, mm-hmm. you know, I'm an actor. I can play whatever role, gay, straight, you know, whatever. And, you know, if you're good enough, you can play whatever role. I don't care if you're playing a doctor, a lawyer, or, you know, somebody that's all good, all bad, whatever. I mean, if you're dedicated to your craft, you're going to apply yourself mm-hmm. and do a good job in whatever role it is. And I think he wanted to make people think, you know, I think a lot of people, after that role, maybe because he did it so well, people thought, oh, I think Robert Preston must be gay. He wasn't gay. It would have been fine if he was, but he wasn't.
Right, he wasn't.
But he did such a good job in portraying the role of Toddy that I think people thought, well, what's going on here? So that's to his credit that he was able to portray a character so realistically that people, you know, got to wondering about his sexual orientation.
Right. And the sounds like the production itself was a very happy production because Blake Edwards let people improvise and they would do, I mean, the final number that he does, The Lady from Seville, was all done in one take because it had to be, because the costume he was wearing was the actual Julie Andrews costume, which didn't fit him. And by the end of the take, it was pretty much torn to shreds with him in it. But then surprisingly, he has a falling out with Blake Edwards and Julie Andrews afterwards, because they want to do a stage version of Victor Victoria. And they are claiming that he said he would do it with Julie Andrews as a big Broadway musical. And of course he's saying, no, I never said that. And I don't think it's a good idea. And of course he turned out to be quite prescient in that because the Broadway production was not well received. But talk about that, because that was kind of surprising. And it sort of I got the impression that he was sort of hurt by the whole thing, that because he'd had such a great working relationship with the two of them.
He was. You know, the Blake Edwards and Julie Andrews and actually the whole cast of both SOB and Victoria, they became such a close-knit family on each of the films. And he you know, felt very close to Blake and to Julie. And one of the things that I think Blake opened up with Robert Preston was Blake did a lot of improvising. He liked, mm-hmm. you know, for the camera to roll and for people to just do their thing and improvise, and whatever take was best he would use in the particular film he was filming. So that was a new thing for Robert Preston. He usually, you know, He had a photographic memory, would get the script down, show up, do his lines. Blake Edwards approached things a little bit differently. It was like, let's fly on the cuff. Yeah, here's the script, but, you know, improvise. And he rose to the challenge. He did, you know, he did very well. So he liked working with Blake. And then you're right. There was some falling out about going, you know, being part of the Broadway production. But one of the things, and I have to kind of agree with Preston's take on it, he was approached many, many times to reprise The Music Man on Broadway, and he refused because he said, it's already on film. I'm not going to compete with myself. There were other issues too. He was older and et cetera. But he said, you know, it's already been, Harold Hill's already been immortalized in film. Why would I compete against myself? It's not going to happen. And I think he felt the same way with Toddy in Victor Victoria. It was been there, done that. His role had been immortalized on screen. He had already gotten the nomination for Best Supporting Actor. He wasn't going to go on Broadway and, you know, and he knew Broadway. And in that particular instance, he wasn't shown a book. He wasn't shown, you know, what the ending of the musical would be, et cetera. Blake Edwards hadn't provided him with this information. So he just wasn't willing to go forward, especially since he had already immortalized the role on screen. And that caused a falling out. And, you know, in talking to family members about that particular time in his life, yes, he was very, very hurt. and disappointed about the reaction, particularly from Blake Edwards, about his refusal to, or him declining to reprise the role on Broadway. As it turned out, because of many issues, funding and a lot of other things, Victor Victoria didn't end up on Broadway until well after Robert Preston was deceased. But even during his lifetime, when there were talks regarding him reprising the role, he just didn't want any part of it. And it did, unfortunately, cause a tear in that relationship, which was very hurtful to him. And, the family, his extended family who's still alive, did confirm that as well. And that it was just such a shame. But I think, following, obviously, Preston's death, Blake Edwards said some very magnanimous things about him. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I don't want to say all was forgotten, but, I think in time that disappointment on Blake Edwards' part dissipated somewhat,
Right.
So.
And speaking of Preston's death, because we're now kind of towards the end of our conversation,
okay.
As he lived his life in such privacy, it carried over to his battle with cancer. I mean, no one really knew how sick he was. I mean, he didn't let anybody know. It kept it to just family.
And not even family. I talked to a couple of the extended family members who said, we didn't know. We didn't know what was going on. And part of it was, yes, his need for privacy, but part of it was his need to shield, especially his brother's children. Mm-hmm. They had gone through so much trauma in losing their parents. He didn't want to re-traumatize them by, putting this on them as well. So they didn't know that he was sick, and they didn't know, any of what he was going through. So yes, he kept that private, was cared for at home, and did maintain the privacy to the end. I think most of his co-stars and fans were in shock when they, the newspapers, the headlines came out and said that he had passed away at age 68.
So, as we wind down here, tell me about, having done all the research you did and putting this book together, what were a couple of the main things that really surprised you about Robert Preston that you didn't know?
I was particularly surprised that he was a Shakespearean trained actor, that he had cut his teeth, not only, of course, in high school, but at the Pasadena Playhouse. And that was kind of amazing to me. And I also wasn't aware of his, I don't want to say approach to humanity, approach to life. Like, as I mentioned before, he was a very forward-thinking person. I saw that in different aspects of his life, different causes that he joined or supported, different stances he took on different issues. And so that surprised me as well, that he was as vocal and as active as he was in various issues. So it's just, and it's also a shame, in doing this, all this research, that, he's been dead now for about 35 years. And it's just a shame that his career was not more widely recognized, that he was more not, his talent was not more widely recognized. And even small things like having a star on the Walk of Fame, et cetera, there's nothing that recognizes his talent, where there are some other people who've maybe been in one movie or, whatever, have a star or multiple stars, and there's nothing for this man anywhere, which is kind of a shame, but it is what it is.
Well, maybe this book will rectify that. That would be nice.
So. It would be
But it is a wonderful book. It is called Robert Preston, Forever the Music Man. And we've been talking to Deborah Warren. Thank you, Deborah. It's been such a delight chatting with you. And congratulations on the book. I'm sure you're getting great response, because there has not been a lot of stuff written about Robert Preston. And he certainly is one of the most versatile actors we've ever seen. So I hope to have you back sometime soon.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
I promise you a happy ending, like the ones that you see on the screen. So if you've had a bad beginning, love will come out winning in the closing scene. And when you find it rough contending with the grind that the world puts us through, I can promise you a happy ending that has you loving me, loving you. I promise you a happy ending, like the one you've been dreaming about, where vows are vowed and knots are knotted, and the preacher's potted as the reel runs out. And so I'm strongly recommending that you pack up your old point of view. I can promise you a happy ending that has you loving me, loving you. Well, that's it, kid. Not so funny, huh? But then, you always did want a love story, didn't you? Well, let me add just one Senate touch. I love you, Mabel Norman. So long, kid.